practical web accessibility tips. Welcome to WebAx, podcast number 34, Design Considerations for Accessibility. This is your host, Dennis.
And I'm back. I'm Ross.
Glad to have you back again, Ross.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Before we get started with our the main subject of our podcast, I guess, do we have any announcements to make or events?
Well, we just came from the World Usability Conference in Michigan State University, and we'll have a podcast about that. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That was yesterday, November 14th, on World Usability Day, I guess it's called. So every year, that was the fourth annual usability and accessibility event that they hold at MSU. Yeah, so that was definitely worthwhile going to. You know, I don't know why they call it the usability and accessibility event, because they don't really talk a whole lot about accessibility.
No, they don't, and there's a kind of here and there. My only guess is that they're kind of tied together to a certain extent, maybe.
Well, I don't argue that, of course, but I think that department maybe is usability and accessibility or something. But
yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Is this kind of put on by a usability / accessibility department, and so they kind of tie them together. Maybe it's just to get more people.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we got some good interviews, but it was shocking how many people didn't want to be recorded.
I know, especially the two guys sitting with us at lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'd say, hey, we do a podcast. Would you like to, you know, talk about what you think about usability? And they're like, ah, nope.
Yeah, I don't want to be on the microphone. But anyways, besides that, not a whole lot going on, except for, I guess, Refresh Detroit. The next meetup is the Wednesday after Thanksgiving. We're going to have it in Brighton again. So if anyone in the area, Southeast Michigan area, is interested in talking about web accessibility and standards and everything, then come meet us and check that out at refresh-detroit.org.
Yep. Anybody we met yesterday who we gave a card to talk to, definitely stop by.
Okay.
And everybody else, too, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully we'll get, I think it sounds like we'll get a few more listeners out of that conference, and we found a few, you know, neat ideas and companies and one other usability podcast that looks pretty interesting, so.
Yeah, I'm a new subscriber to that one.
What's the URL for that?
Designcritique.net.
Okay, so, yeah, I gotta go check that out.
Yeah, they seem pretty good. They kind of review the usability of everyday items such as irons and rice cookers.
Yeah, everyday things. Yeah. All kinds of miscellaneous items and cars, and I don't know if they do, I think they do like a computer too, but yeah, it's pretty interesting. They do all kinds of stuff, so it's not just usability on for a website, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure they have good things to say, and I'm impressed so far, so we're checking out.
Yeah, and that was neat that the guy, Tim or Tom, was like pretty impressed that we've been doing an accessibility podcast, so that was cool.
Yeah, to get them to plug it.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the main content of this podcast is design considerations for accessibility. And Ross and I started listing off a whole bunch of things, and we're actually, it's not really going to be called part two, but in two or three weeks, we're going to have another podcast for just general coding considerations for accessibility and just not specific techniques on how to do things, but just a bunch of different things to keep in mind when you're coding the design for accessibility. So
yeah, we kind of came up with a big list and realized there's two parts of it, you know, how you are actually going to design and lay out and structure the site versus how you're going to code it. And so we figured, you know, two podcasts might be a little easier.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get to it. The first subject is sticking to conventions, which I highly recommend. I know Paul Bolag talked about that, too, a little while back. A more usable and accessible website is obviously where one, it's easier for a person to use it, and for it to be easier for them to use, they have to be, you know, if they're more familiar with the way it's laid out, the easier it's going to be for them to use it. So sticking to layout conventions is probably a good idea.
I mean, it's just kind of the basic things where you go to, you know, 50 different websites, and this is where things usually are. If you think about it from someone who's not real familiar with the web, it's pretty confusing. You know, every web page is laid out differently. You have to use it differently. So anywhere where you can kind of keep your page consistent to what most other pages do makes it easier to use and makes it more accessible.
So someone with cognitive disabilities or just a new user to your website, you know, or to the web in general, can use it easier. So some examples would be, like, the search box usually is in the upper right corner of a website. The main or general, like, global navigation items are usually across the top, while, like, sub-navigations are usually on the side, left side or right side.
And then also, the use of icons can be really helpful. A lot of websites do that, and it helps not only as far as, like, recognizing that, you know, the little envelope stands for email, but people with cognitive disabilities are going to have a harder time, you know, reading and comprehending email this to a friend versus seeing the little icon and identifying that.
Yeah, and it's a good idea to stick to the conventions of the icons, you know, like an icon for going to your home should be like, you know, the little, what do you call it, the little shape of a house, you know, kind of thing usually, or some kind of alternative version of that.
Yeah, something that, you know, it makes sense that it looks like what most people use for a home. You wouldn't want to put, like, a dog icon or something like that.
Yeah. Or, like, or, you know what, a good one to talk about is, like, that RSS icon. That's a newer one that's coming becoming a convention. Well, there's two, really. There's the one that says RSS in white letters with the orange background, but I think one that's becoming more popular, because a lot of people are like, what the hell's RSS? But one that's becoming more popular is, you know, the square orange block, and it has the three little curvy lines, like, on it.
Yeah, and that's kind of, because RSS is still relatively new. It's like you can have an icon and everybody can use it, but if you don't know what RSS is, it's still a little confusing, so I'd almost like to see an icon that says subscribe or something along those lines, where it kind of tells people who don't know what RSS is that this is sort of what it does.
Yeah, but well, I guess the people are using the phrase, like, you know, news feeds or something like that more, and I know Microsoft, of course, came up with their own terminology, so, but we won't give them the time, so.
Sounds good.
All right, so another design consideration is for navigation. Well, just real fast, we'll say about skip nav or skip to content, and that was covered in an early podcast on WebAx. It's a good idea if you have an accessible website. You wanna make this skip nav link visible. Some sites, and I mean, we could go on and on about this, but some sites, you know, when you mouse over it, it becomes more visible, or like if you tab to it, it doesn't show, but when you tab through it, like, it appears. But whatever way you decide, you know, that's obviously a consideration when you're designing the page.
Yeah, I mean, in general, it's good to have, and some sites kind of make it, it's only really usable if you have style sheets off or if you're using a screen reader, and that's kind of their choice, but whether you make it visible or not, it's good to have, and if it's visible, that's even better.
There might be some other very few instances, you know, a small percentage of your audience might use it, like, if they have, you know, if they turn off the style sheets or something, it might be valuable to have. But anyways, a couple more considerations for navigation is it's a good idea to indicate the current page that you're on in the navigation area, and then it's also a good idea to indicate the pages that you have already visited.
Yep, that's always important. So it's kind of like visual cues where you are on the site. And a lot of people don't indicate visited pages, which is too bad because it's so simple to have, you know, an A visited tag where you just have a slightly different color or a different color altogether. Maybe it's underlined or not.
Or if you're really nifty, you could put the little tick box or the check mark. We Americans would call it the check mark, you know, next to, like, your main navigation elements that the user has been to already.
Yeah, that's starting to get pretty popular, and I mean, it helps, you know, so if you got two pages that are similar, you can know, okay, I've been there, time to check the next one.
Yeah, and again, that's better for, you know, people that are not as you know, accustomed to using websites or people with cognitive disabilities and stuff. That kind of brings up the next element. It's kind of related as breadcrumbs. There's a good and bad side to those, too, but it's at least consider that in your design if you're going to use breadcrumbs or not and where to place them.
Yeah, so that way you can see, again, where you've been, how you got there, where you're at now, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Let's move on to color considerations.
Okay.
Obviously, when you're designing a website, you need to consider the color, and there's a lot of psychological and marketing aspects for that. As far as accessibility goes, there's, we'll mention at least a few things to consider. Number one is ensure there's enough color contrast in your design, so people with low vision and color blindness like can still view the site and see what they need to see. Because if you don't have enough contrast, then it'll be very difficult to read. And I think that's a priority one consideration.
And there's tools out there that'll test and kind of show you what it'll look like to someone who's colorblind. So even though you might be able to read it, or even if you have poor vision, you might be able to read it, someone who's colorblind might not be able to. So it's important to test that also.
Or even, you know, I mean, it could be due to if your computer isn't that good, or like my brother had this computer in the monitor, like, I don't know what happened to it, but like it got all dark on him all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, so for a year, he used this computer, a laptop, and, like, it was kind of difficult for him to use. He could still use it, but, it was, like, the monitor was really dark, and there was nothing he could do. It was broken. So,
yeah. You know,
that would also help, too, for, like, if your monitor isn't as good or if it's broken or whatever.
Yeah, I noticed with CRT monitors, it kind of as they get older, the quality gets worse and worse. And that's something, you know, people have the same computer for 3 or 4 years, the monitor gets worse and worse. You want to make sure that they can still read your site.
Yeah. So what do you think about the light on dark or dark on light argument? I personally go along with the, supposedly it's a fact that the dark letters on light background is, in the long run, is easier to read.
Yeah, I've read that, and I think it kind of depends on the monitor itself. I mean, monitors, as opposed to paper, they project light, where paper reflects light. If, you know, especially if you're in a dark room and your monitor's projecting all this light, I know a lot of people, it's kind of too bright for them, it gives them a headache, so there's kind of this balance where even people who are using, like, light backgrounds and dark text will kind of not do a pure white, not do a pure black to kind of compensate for that, but I think visually, me personally, I like dark on light better. But I think readability-wise, it seems like light on dark, for me, is easier.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because maybe it's just because I associate, you know, a piece of paper is, you know, white background, black text, but...
Yeah, I think, yeah, in general, it's better to go with darker text on light background, you know, unless it's some kind of, like alternative, like, art site or something, then you want your black background and, like, gray text and all that stuff, but... Yeah, so but I guess that's... Besides, you know, making sure there's enough contrast and everything, is obviously you want your colors. You want to design for the content of your site, of course, and all that marketing stuff. So,
yeah, kind of consider how much text you have, and if there's going to be a lot of text, take that into consideration. Versus if you have a few short blurbs on each page versus a lot of pictures, and you can probably get more experimental.
Okay, so another, I believe another priority one color consideration is never use color to convey information. And that might be, you know, more for somebody writing the content, but it's also true for when you're designing the when you're designing your site. But if you don't know, the general idea is if you have, you know, say you have a red button and a green button for no and yes or something, then you should add at least text saying yes and no to convey that content, to convey that meaning, or in addition to even, like, change the shape of the object, like a red octagonal, like, stop sign maybe thing for no, and then, you know, a circle or whatever for yes.
Yeah, and I see this most kind of being broken for forms. You know, people will say, items marked in red must be filled out. Well, yeah, if you don't have a style,
you can't tell red from green.
Yeah, or you can't tell red from green, then, you know,
or if you've turned off your style sheets or whatever.
Yeah, and there's a million different situations where that's useless. So.
All right, and then another, the last color consideration is if you change one color of a link, an anchor state, you should change them all. So, I mean, most people do that nowadays, like, designate every state like the active, you know, visited, hover. But if you do change one of them, make sure you change them all, because or else the default colors are going to work for the ones you haven't changed, and then you're going to end up with a mess.
Yeah, it gets really confusing.
All right, well, let's move to layout considerations.
A lot of people have a style sheet specific for low vision or large text or high contrast. And anytime you're kind of catering to people who have poor vision, it makes more sense to convert a multi-column site into one column and just kind of linearize the content. That way you can make the text even bigger, you know, the line lengths don't get, you know, ridiculously small, and it gets much easier to read, and people have to scroll more, but it's going to be easier for them to scroll than to try and read a sentence that is 3 words long, or 3 words per line length.
Yeah, and hopefully, if your site is already created with web standards, you know, and CSS, then, as it should be, then creating that low vision style sheet should be relatively easy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy to shift stuff around and change the width, that sort of thing, so use web standards.
Another consideration is, you probably heard this one before, is about scrolling. And, you know, I don't think it's that big a deal if you need to scroll or not, but if you need to scroll down to get some content, then to try to indicate that to the user.
Yeah, you want to make sure that it's obvious that you can scroll down. And kind of one way to do that is just have a universal footer at the bottom of every page, so people know that they don't hit the bottom of the page until they hit that footer. And kind of the idea is that also, if people start scrolling down and they don't see the navigation anymore, they don't see the breadcrumbs, they don't see where they're located on the page, it starts to get a little disorienting because all they see is text. So that's kind of one thing to consider. And they say try and keep a page with about less than 4 pages worth of scrolling. If you took your resolution and copy that 4 times, that's about where you want to stop and have like a second page for the same content.
Okay, so if you've got a really, really long article, once you've scrolled down about 4 pages, then you should probably create a second page for that article.
Yeah, generally it makes it easier to read and navigate and that sort of thing.
And where did you find this 5 to 10% of users won't bother or notice that they can scroll down?
I forgot where I read that, and, you know, who knows how valid that is as far as sample size and stuff like that.
But, sounds pretty believable to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, they get to a page, if it's not obvious, the scroll bar's there, but it's way out on the right-hand corner, and, you know, you don't really focus on that. So I can see where people wouldn't notice, like, oh, I have to scroll down. And when you start using kind of, like, fixed elements, I think that probably gets worse as well.
Yeah, as far as, I mean, and that kind of leads to the point, like, for when you're designing the content on the page, that the most important content should be first.
Yeah, I think, didn't Nielsen say something like that? It should be like a reverse triangle. It should be most important, and then second most, and then...
Yeah, kind of like newspaper, if you think about it, because people scan newspapers, and the when you write a newspaper article, all the most important stuff is supposed to be first, so...
Yeah, front page and big letters, that sort of thing, makes sense.
All right, another consideration for the layout design is to try to keep... I know Ross and I and a lot of developers out there try to keep the width of your design approximately 760 pixels wide, and that obviously is to fit into the 800 by 600 screen resolution that I believe, I'm not really sure, but I think 30 or 35% of people are still using that resolution.
Yeah, I've heard a whole bunch of different ranges, but enough where you should consider it. I mean, even at 10%, you got to figure that's, you know, 1 out of 10 people, which is a fair amount of people, you know, who are visiting your site. And it's not only technology constraints, but a lot of people who have poor vision use 800 by 600 just because it makes the text bigger.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, but as far as, like, mobile devices and PDAs and stuff, if you got a fixed resolution of 1024, you know, for 1024, I mean, there's going to be a whole lot of horizontal scrolling on a PDA, so...
The wider it gets, the less usable it gets, so that's something to be considered.
All right, that's text considerations.
All right. Sans serif fonts are generally easier to read on screen, where serif fonts are easier to read on paper. And basically that's if you look at a text, if it has kind of like those little hangs, Times New Roman, for example, is serif. And basically the serif refers to like the little, they've got kind of like little danglies at the end.
Yeah, that if you don't know about typography, it's the ends of the actual letters themselves, the little curly and rolls and stuff, like how Times and what else? Georgia?
That's serif? Georgia, Garamond, and...
those are serif fonts, because the serifs are those little squiggly things that make the writing look fancier or whatever.
Yeah, and then sans serif fonts are sans is means not, so not serif, so they don't have those, and that'd be like...
Well, it means without, actually.
Yeah, without. Thank you. So, Verdana and Arial and that sort of thing, Helvetica.
So we're recommending... Well, I like Verdana.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, so sans serif fonts are easier to read. Like Helvetica, Verdana, and what are a couple other ones?
Arial,
duh.
There's a handful.
Yeah,
that kind of goes.
It's a regular game.
Yeah. And that goes back to the whole, like, paper reflects light, screens emit light, and I guess your eyes kind of scan the top of letters. And on paper, having the serifs on there makes it easier to recognize the letter quicker, but that's not the case on screen, which is why, you know, so many people start to develop sans serif fonts. For example, Verdana was made by Microsoft.
Really?
Yeah, that was kind of because, you know, fonts didn't have anti-aliasing on computers for Microsoft, so they kind of designed a font that looked good, small, without anti-aliasing. And that's kind of where Verdana came up with. So they basically they screwed up, and that was their way of making it better.
Oh, okay. You were breaking up. I was like, couldn't hear you the last 10 seconds, but I don't know if our audience heard that. But so basically, Microsoft created Verdana because of the anti-aliasing issue.
Yeah, they didn't have any anti-aliasing built into Windows at the time, and that was a way to make text readable. At they designed the font to be very readable at small sizes.
That's cool.
Sizes.
Oh, yeah. Then there's also the what is it, Trebuchet or something?
Yeah, Trebuchet MS.
That's Microsoft too, then, right?
Yeah, and that's actually, it's kind of a hybrid between serif and sans serif. It does have serifs, but it's not extremely pronounced. So
yeah. All right.
Well,
let's move on to a couple more directly related issues to accessibility, and that is ensure your font size can be enlarged in your website without breaking the design, so your users can, if they have low vision or whatever. You know, and I like to increase the, on my monitor, the resolution in my main monitor is pretty high, so like, a lot of times I like to just enlarge the text just for my own, so I don't have to strain my eyes so much, but... Make sure.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I've got a 19-inch external that I run high resolution for, like, Photoshop or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to read a web page with tiny font is, like, forget about it.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, for anyone who wants to enlarge text for whatever reason, then, you know, make sure that your design doesn't break or it's still readable when you enlarge the text. Another more general consideration is your headers should be larger than the regular text. That might seem obvious. Sometimes it's not as obvious as it is, but it's to indicate, you know, importance that, you know, a header one or two, you know, should obviously be larger than three or four. Try not to break that convention, and that's just because of the importance of the meaning behind that and for anyone with cognitive disabilities.
I mean, it makes it easier to scan and comprehend if you have a cognitive disability, and there's all sorts of reasons to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point for scanning and all kinds of other reasons, but fonts should be good-sized. Not everyone knows how to resize the text.
Yeah, this is something I just read. There's a blog about web design called Smiley Cat at smileycat.com. I guess they did a study, or I can't remember, maybe he linked to a study where they looked at what percentage of users of a set of websites used anything other than the default text size, and it was something like only 0.3% actually did. So to me, that kind of says if you look at, you know, 10% of the market still uses 800 by 600, and a good portion of that's for readability reasons, a lot of people don't know how to resize text. So you want to keep that in mind. You know, people are, they're viewing your site, and they don't know how to enlarge the text. So you want to make it at least a decent size to begin with.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, that brings up an argument about placing the text resize, you know, buttons or tools on your website itself.
Yeah.
And some people say, yeah, that's great. You know, the user can click it to automatically resize the text. And I guess I have to agree with that, that it is a good idea, and that helps the user. But I do, at the same time, have a problem with that, because I think that's the responsibility of the browsers.
Yeah, I agree.
The companies that develop these browsers need to make that tool or that technology, you know, more prevalent, you know, on the browser. I mean, it's already incorporated in the browser. You know, why can't they just put a couple text enlarge and text, you know, decrease, like a couple simple buttons?
Yeah, I know. I mean, yep. You think that
then we don't have to design it.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't have to put it, why does everybody have to reinvent the wheel and put it on their own website? Just put it in the browser where it should be.
Yeah, and I mean, you think that that's something that could prevent somebody from getting any information on a website. They don't know how to resize the text is too small. Why not make, you know, a plus minus button right in the browser?
So. Yeah, and I mean, IE7 and a lot of other browsers have the zoom in tool, or, you know, the resize the site, you know?
Yeah.
Zoom in or zoom out 150% or whatever. So, if they're doing that, I don't know why they can't put increase the text. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense. And what I do, and this has its kind of fallbacks too, is I try and, on my accessibility pages, give people instructions on how to resize the text, which, you know, I kind of figure that they read that, they can go to another site, and now they know how to do it, but not
everybody. You mean your help page.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you've read the WebEx blog, then you know what I mean by that.
Yeah. So, but I mean, not everybody's going to find that, and that could be totally lost on some people, so that it has its own drawbacks.
So I suppose for now that's a good idea to put the increased text size button on there, but
yeah, until the browser manufacturers get a clue or two.
Anyways, we're running out of time, so let's just go through some of these last considerations fairly quickly. Just some various other design considerations for accessibility. One is to limit the use of Flash, and that can be a whole other episode, but basically my point is, if you're going to use Flash, you know, just limit the use of it and place like little animation or interactive elements like in certain portions of your site and make the content accessible.
Yep. Don't make your site depend on Flash. And also make sure you have print style sheets, because a lot of people print out pages because it's easier to read on paper.
Yeah, and you can make it look really cool and print out much better, you know, for people with a special style sheet designated for printing. And then, well, maybe the next point is for the part two, but the graphical buttons with text, well, when you're designing, when you're implementing your interface and you have graphical buttons, it really should be text or an actual HTML button with graphical backgrounds.
Yeah, and that way you can resize it.
Without the pixelation.
Yeah, without pixelation.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, so that's really important.
So the text and buttons, like, resize nicely, where when you resize the graphic, it's going to be all distorted and pixelated. But
yeah.
It's a good idea to include some kind of site help or accessibility page or guides, so if someone wants to know, they could go and see, you know, what accessibility features you have on your site, and maybe list, if you're using access keys, you know, to list those or whatever.
Yeah, I'm just to kind of inform people a little more.
No flickering.
Yep.
So that's another basic accessibility guideline, and that is point of that, I know there's a couple points, but the main one is to avoid causing any, help me out here, Ross.
Seizures, I believe?
Seizures, yeah.
Yeah, that would be really bad.
You don't want to give people seizures with your website. But,
yeah, some people are real sensitive to flickering, and that can, you know, cause seizures, so
yeah, and
definitely,
you know,
no flickering.
Exactly. And let's see, if you're using multimedia like audio, you know, plan in your design for text-only a version somewhere, you know, and for links for that. And if when you're doing video, plan for captioning your audio with the video.
Yep, and, you know, you can do that. You know, you think TV has closed captioning, so kind of the same idea, that if you have a video with people talking, that people can get the same content without having to see or hear it.
Right. And there's different ways of doing that depending on what medium you're using. If you have any questions or input or comments on that, then leave a comment on the WebAx blog or send me an email. I've done some captioning with Smile and Sammy, you know, for video, and it's pretty neat. It's fun to use, and you know, you could customize it and everything, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to do it if you have video.
All right, well, I think that wraps it up for design considerations for accessibility.
Yeah, shoot us any emails if you have any questions. We'd be happy to answer them on the next show.
Great, so we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. The WebAx blog and podcast is located at webaxe.blogspot.com. webaxe.blogspot.com. Email WebAx at webax@gmail.com. webaxe@gmail.com. To leave a voice message, call 206-203-0585. WebAx is sponsored by Check Engine USA, website tune-ups and overhauls. www.checkengineusa.com.